1st, and we are no April Fool's joke here. We will open a work session on House Bill 2484. Linda Ludwig, would you come forward? And anyone else? Let's see, we have, I think, up to dash 10 amendments on this thing at this point, none of which have been accepted by the committee. But Linda, could you update us on 2484 as far as the varying amounts of amendments, that kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities, I would love to do that, although I haven't seen any of the new amendments in my hands. I do believe I know what some of them say, but certainly probably would need your committee members to help fill in the gaps, other than the one that I do know about specifically.
I think we have somewhere up to dash 10s that have been drafted on this bill. What we're going to do is put together a work group on 2484, and I will name to that work group Representative Anderson, Dennis Mulvihill, Linda Ludwig, Representative Ackerman, Representative Greenlick, and Representative Crummel. I will ask them to come back to this committee on April 18th at our Wednesday meeting on April 18th and hopefully put together a draft bill on annexation that will be acceptable and can work for all parties. So, thank you, Linda. I appreciate your being here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will close the work session on House Bill 2484 and open a work session on House Bill 2755. And we have some amendments on that bill, but I'm not quite sure who has them. Sam?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members, you should have before you, there should be dash 1 and dash 2 amendments. Most recent that was provided was the dash 2s, in which the dash 2 amendment will restore lines 1 through 4 on page 3, and allows the county to waive the requirement for parcels greater than 80 acres to be shown on a plat. And the amendment will also restore lines 13 to 16 on pages 5 of the measure that details parcels greater than 80 acres that are not surveyed and approximate and can show that the approximate acreage be shown and identified that it's unsurveyed. And those would be for the large parcels out in the county areas. And they were drafted by Art Slack, and I think Tom Gallagher also had the input on that one.
Mr. Slack, Mr. Gallagher, would you come forward?
Mr. Chairman, I'm here representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. I think both the Dash 1 amendments and the Dash 2 amendments make this bill acceptable to all of the parties involved and will improve the permitting process that accounts for people who are in the spot process.
Will the Dash 2s incorporate the changes in the Dash 1?
Yes, we need both amendments, Mr. Chair.
You'll need both amendments.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. As you will recall, at the initial public hearing, we raised a concern with regard to the removal from the partition plats of unsurveyed parcels over 10 acres because of the concern that we have with lawfully created parcels. As a result of expressing that concern and working with the surveyors, we have brought forth the Dash 2 amendments. Those amendments, as the committee administrator has indicated, restore much of the language that we had concern about, and there is one little amendment that we drafted in there also in terms of a small change in language. But I want to convey to you that 2755 with the Dash 2 amendments certainly address our concerns, and we would urge that you accept the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Gallagher or Mr. Slack? Seeing none, we'll thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. And thanks, committee.
And Since we are in a work session, the chair would look for a motion on first the dash one amendments.
So moved.
Representative Anderson has moved the dash ones. Any objection? The dash ones are accepted. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2755.
Representative Anderson moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2755. Any discussion? Anyone in disagreement? Seeing none, we'll move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2755. And Representative Greenwood, the chair would look for a motion.
I move we approve House Bill 2755 and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I further move it be put on the consent calendar.
As amended?
As amended with amendments dash one dash two.
Representative Greenlick has moved House Bill 2755 as amended to the consent calendar and the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Greenwood?
Aye.
Dolan?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Chair
votes aye. 2755A, as amended, is moved to the consent calendar. Okay, group. We will close the work session on 2755. And we will open, we're waiting actually for Representative Farr. House Bill 3301 is her bill, and she is not here to testify yet, so we will wait till she is able to get here to open the public hearing on House Bill 3301. We'll advise the audience that we may interrupt the next bill when Representative Farr comes in. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill... Oh, there is Representative Farr. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3301. Representative? Your timing was impeccable.
Chair Clark, may I invite Bill Van Vactor, who's the Lane County Administrator, to join me at the table?
Certainly. By the way, committee, you have been supplied, each of you, with a draft, LC 3536, which is a draft of proposed revision to Measure 37. This is just for your personal edification at this point.
A little light reading for the weekend.
A little light reading for the weekend, yes. Representative Farr, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Debbie Farr. I am State Representative for House District 14. I appreciate the opportunity to open discussion today about House Bill 3301, the formation of county service districts. I have introduced this bill at the request of Lane County. This bill is important to me because public safety is important to me and to my community. In recent crime data available, Lane County ranks above the state average for drug offenses, above average for overall crime rate, and above average for eighth graders who have used alcohol in the last 30 days. Knowing as I do that persistent methamphetamine abuse, youth substance abuse, domestic violence, and property crimes continue to vex our community, I applaud our top public safety officials working on a more stable and sustainable system to deal with felony adult and youth offenders. I am pleased to help in that regard by sponsoring this bill. With that, I would like to turn our discussion over to Bill Van Vactor, the county administrator, to tell you a little more about the need for this legislative remedy.
Chair Garrard and members of the House Committee on Land Use, my name is, as Representative Farr indicated, is Bill Van Vactor. I currently serve as the county administrator, which also means I'm the budget officer for Lane County government. And I want to begin by thanking you for this opportunity to testify and to thank Representative Farr for introducing what Lane County considers very important legislation. Lane County's public safety system has been under serious erosion for a significant number of years. We are down from a capacity
in our jail and have lost 119 beds. They sit empty, unfortunately. Our youth services department has a capacity of 96 beds, but it operates at only one-third of capacity. In the district attorney's office, we are down from 38 deputy district attorneys to 22. We no longer prosecute many property crimes, and we process many methamphetamine cases as violations rather than as a felony or even as a misdemeanor. Our parole and probation staff carry caseloads of over 100 offenders per probation and parole officer. As you are probably familiar, the driving cause of this is an increased cost of personnel. Annually, our costs increase at about 6%, and our revenue under the Oregon's property tax system only goes up about 3%. These services that I've identified, prosecution of state crimes, incarceration, parole and probation, juvenile detention, alcohol and drug, court-ordered treatment, are services that the statutes direct the county to perform. In fact, the district attorney, as you are well aware, is in fact a state officer, who in fact is paid by the state of Oregon. And these are not services that are otherwise provided by cities. These are primary core services, and because what we are proposing is a county service district organized under Chapter 451, it will have the same governing body that currently exists, the Board of County Commissioners. So this is not like we would be creating a separate new district like a fire district, which would have a separate governing body. What we found operating in Oregon under ballot measures 5, 47, and 50 is that there is no way to increase property taxes on a permanent basis for a county government or for a city government for that matter. We view public safety as a core service, and we are reluctant to place these services on a special operating levy, which may or may not be renewed in future years. And as we operate under the Oregon system, I'm sure you are familiar, special operating levies are far more subject to compression than permanent rate, than services provided under a permanent rate. So as we analyze our options and we consider them, we are strongly looking at a public safety district to be placed before the voters on November 7th, 2006. And I want to emphasize, this will only happen if we get through the entire process and the voters approve it on that day. When we began this process, we were concerned that there was a section of current state law which arguably prohibits overlapping 451 service districts. And inside the Eugene Springfield metropolitan area, we already have an ORS 451 district. It's called the Lane County Metropolitan Wastewater Service District. The history here is important. In 1977-1978, the two cities, Eugene and Springfield, were looking for a way to finance the local share of their regional wastewater treatment plant. The two cities came to the county and asked them to form the Metropolitan Wastewater Service District so that the matter could be placed on the ballot, which it was in 1978, in the form of a single vote, because the concern was if it went out in two separate votes, the two cities may not agree. The good news here is that in 1978, the citizens approved the bond measure, and the rest is history. The plant was built. It operates today. Thank you very much. And in fact, and this is even better news, the bonds have been paid off. But unfortunately, the Lane County Metropolitan Wastewater Service District still exists technically. We still receive a few residual property tax payments and so forth, and have not yet proceeded to dissolve that. Hence the conflict and the possible concern that the technical language of the statute may cause a problem. And that is why we have proposed this legislation. I understand that the City of Eugene may appear and express some concerns about this legislation. I'd like to remind the committee that with the deletion of paragraph 3 of section 2, and as we make our application to the Lane County Boundary Commission, by the way, the last Boundary Commission in the state of Oregon, we will, if we are to include the area inside the City of Eugene, which we are most certainly interested in, we will need to get approval from the Eugene City Council before we can even forward that application to the Boundary Commission. So the Eugene City Council will be actively involved in this proposal. In addition, we also have in our local area what we call the Metro Plan. It's our regional comprehensive plan, and we need to process a minor surgical amendment to that plan to provide for this district. And that also needs the approval of the Eugene City Council, and that is scheduled for a joint elected official meeting on April 19th. The two city councils and the Board of Commissioners will meet to discuss that. So that is yet another opportunity for the city of Eugene, if they have concerns, to express them to our governing body and to deal with that. And from our point of view, really gives the city of Eugene two bites of this apple before going very far forward with this project, and certainly well before it gets to the voters, hopefully in November of 2006. So, in conclusion, we respectfully request that House Bill 3301, as I think the amendments were provided you this afternoon, be enacted so that that conflict with state law is avoided and the citizens are ultimately given a chance to approve or reject this proposal. And thank you very much. And do you have any questions?
Any questions of Representative Farr or Representative Ackerman?
Yes, as Mr. Van Vactor, I'm trying to understand the difference between the formation of this special taxing district and the revenue it will raise, and the alternative, which would be perhaps the county just enacting a five-year sewer levy for the same purposes. Aside from the obvious that the five-year levy would expire by its own terms, what would be the differences between these two approaches?
Well, obviously the biggest concern is that an increase in a permanent tax rate through the formation of a district is a permanent base of money. And the concerns with the special operating levies, I think, are twofold. One is that they have to be renewed, and so you would have the circumstance of your vital core services subject to non-renewal should the voters at any given period not approve that. And then second of all, when there is compression, and we have several areas in Lane County getting close to the $10 cap, when there is compression, the compression comes off of the special operating levies first, and so they are reduced first, and the net effect of that is that it's not as stable a base of revenue as is a permanent operating levy.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative, are there amendments coming to this bill?
Before you, you see a copy of the bill, and the amended section is outlined in black. I've already instructed Legislative Council to amend out that section with dash one amendments.
Okay.
Seeing no further questions, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Bonnie Bettman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Gerard and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bonnie Bettman. I represent Ward 1 in Eugene City Council. I'm also a member of the Intergovernmental Relations Committee. I would very much like to thank you for this opportunity to discuss House Bill 3301, which would enable the creation of service districts with boundaries that overlap the city limits.
Bonnie, could you move the microphone a little closer to you, please? Thank you very much.
And I also wanted to express my appreciation for the amendment that has been drafted to protect some of local approval on the part of the city. Regardless of that, the city of Eugene still remains in opposition to that bill. There are two major issues of concern regarding special districts. One is finances, and the other is preemption of home rule authority intrinsic in special district legislation. I'll attempt to summarize those issues for you. I want to let you know that just before spring break, City Council took a vote, and the City of Eugene is on record as opposing special district legislation. Special districts have been a topic of discussion at the city for a number of years, both from the city's financial perspective and at the county's initiative. Just like Lane County and many other jurisdictions in this state, Eugene is faced with a very serious financial constraint, which necessitates careful weighing and balancing of the services that we're able to provide with the available constrained funds. We, like everyone else, have taken multiple drastic, creative, and painful cuts, we have been forced to choose between essential services and valuable services, capital expenditures and operational expenditures. We even considered formation of a special district for public safety or fire and emergency services for the city. The city council opposed it then, and we have opposed special districts on several occasions since, and we still oppose them. We considered at our Intergovernmental Relations Committee the amendment, and we still have opted to take a position of strong opposition to this bill because of the underlying issues with the special district. One of the first major issues is financial. Every jurisdiction is facing similar challenges. Everything from escalating costs of PERS liability to increasing health care costs. This vastly challenges, it's exacerbated by the revenue reductions from voter-approved property tax limitations. I can fully appreciate Wayne County's predicament. It is serious, and what's more is that their service gaps impact the city's public safety services directly, especially their jail matrix system, and there are many other county financial priorities that impact the city as well. I wanted to mention that I'm very familiar with the public safety issues in the region. I have served on the city's police commission for 4 years, and every year that I've been on the city council and have participated in budget discussions, I have been personally active and involved and responsible for increasing our public safety budget, increasing the resources allocated to our police department, and I've done that by reprioritizing other services. Given such a universal scenario of sacrifice, why would our state legislatures bestow a financial advantage to one jurisdiction while delivering a financial disadvantage to another? Compression is no longer a theoretical threat. It is a very real side effect of the overlapping service district boundaries proposed in this bill. The city of Eugene is already experiencing compression of our local youth option levy for a loss of nearly $89,000. The compression calculations are so complex that even our knowledgeable financial staff say it is impossible to predict which city services will be the next victim of compression. If and when the proposed service district is formed, which includes our city limits, which state legislature wants to come to Eugene and tell our voters, yes, you voted to fund the youth levy, and you voted to fund the school option levy, and the library levy, but now that money is going to the special district at the county, and your youth and schools cannot have it. A major problem with the proposed service district is that it will supersede the city's authority to raise revenue by compression. Here is a quote from a memo provided to the Lane County Board of Commissioners from the Lane County Sheriff's Office and the Lane County Administration dated August 25, 2004, that helps describe this scenario. A special district may provide more stable and adequate funding, this, and I quote, for the district's particular services that can be provided with the county's permanent prop than can be provided with the, I'm going to start over. A special district may provide more stable and adequate funding for the district's particular services that can be provided with the county's permanent property tax rate limit because a special district typically has a voter-approved permanent property tax limit dedicated for its purposes and not shared with other programs and services or with other time-limited local option levies. I hope you can see how this is a major problem for the city. I'd also like to pose a financial question regarding the formation of special districts. Right now, approximately 70% of the county's general fund is allocated to public safety. What happens to that money if and when a new stream of revenue is established through a special district? Is it refunded? Will they find things to spend it on? This is exactly the question that I asked of Commissioner Green when he and Sheriff Clements presented their special district proposal to the council last fall. At that time, he said they didn't know. They hadn't addressed that yet. Do you know? Shouldn't there be an answer before moving forward? In a letter to the Eugene Mayor and City Councilors dated September 1st, 2004, Commissioner Green stated the following, quote, "To address the shortfall in resources as a result of Measure 5 and other voter approved property tax reductions, we have presented the issue to our citizens numerous times. We have tried a broad-based public safety property tax measure put together by a public safety coordinating council. We tried a similar measure as an income tax surcharge. We tried a property tax measure in a specific geographic area of the McKenzie Valley, seeking approval for an enhanced level of law enforcement. We have tried capital bond measures to expand capacity at the jail, expand the intake center, and acquire a new emergency communication system. While a few of the measures came close, they all failed. Basically, this special district is a tax increase on county residents to circumvent what are already caps and limitations on the ability for jurisdictions to raise revenue. I would like to point out two specifics in that quote that I gave you before I address the main underlying concept. First, why was the county seeking additional capacity for the jail when the actual service gaps are operational? The jail already has underutilized capacity due to inadequate staffing, as does the new juvenile center. The matrix provided by the county showing needed cuts and service gaps were all operational. Another troubling point in Commissioner Green's statement is about the rural taxpayers that are unwilling to support services that will benefit them exclusively. Why should city taxpayers subsidize rural services through the vehicle of a special district when rural voters won't? But the general gist of the comments and the purpose of this bill is to finance essential services that the county is mandated to provide. Special districts, as described in our local comprehensive plan, are intended to provide services to unincorporated areas only on a temporary basis until they're annexed. Special districts were not intended as a vehicle to raise taxes. Here's another excerpt from the Board of County Commissioners memo summarizing the relevant Metro Plan policy. The Metro Plan is our comprehensive plan for the Eugene Springfield area, including everything within the urban growth boundary. Metro Plan Growth Management Policy 15 addresses creation of new service districts and states that service districts are considered interim service delivery methods. The Metro Plan calls for annexations to occur over time and existing service districts within the urban growth boundary to be dissolved. Special districts are not intended as a budget remedy, but as a tool to ensure orderly development in anticipation of annexation. Again, I quote from the memo to the Board of County Commissioners. Any proposed new special district within the area of the Metro Plan must be consistent with the plan. Depending on the content of a public safety service district, the Metro Plan does appear to contain policies and perhaps definitions that might act as obstacles to formation of a new district. This highlights the other major problem with the bill. It is inconsistent with our locally adopted comprehensive plan. If the state legislature takes action that preempts our major locally adopted multi-jurisdictional land use plan, that constitutes a preemption of home rule authority. Passage of this bill preempts our Metro Plan and the public process required to amend the plan. It prejudices and predetermines an outcome to a local land use issue. We will be forced to amend the plan to make it consistent with the new state statute, and that takes away our local decision-making authority on what is a quintessential local policy determination. Inclusive or exclusive of the proposed new amendment, overlapping special districts supersede a city's fundamental role as primary providers of urban services, and that is preemption of local authority as well. In addition, it inhibits our ability to depend on local option levies to fund services. The good news is that if you oppose the bill, Wayne County or any jurisdiction still retains the ability to utilize the existing local process to pursue a special district. The difference is it is a local process involving the community and the elected officials in deciding how best to manage local budget shortfalls and meet local expectations for essential services. I wanted to mention one other issue, and that is that this bill, as it's written, is an enabling legislation for the special districts and to overlap.
It is non, it's not specific to the specific issues, the specific services that the county is proposing. Once it's established, anything under its umbrella of services can be, they can create, or anybody in the state can create a special district under that umbrella. So that's all I have to say for now. I very, very much appreciate your attention to my comments, and I'm available for questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 4301? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3301 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3135. Sam?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, the committee, House Bill 3135 is one which required the Oregon Department of Energy to generate impact, environmental impact statement, and to allow for site certificate to be granted only if the applicant showed the need for generating capacity, and that the applicant can obtain land use approval from the local government, and that there will be a disclosure of financial ability and criminal history of the applicant. This will make changes in the ORS Chapter 646, which is the chapter which has regulations which for the siting of new energy generating facilities is located in that chapter.
Representative Barnard. I should be coming out there and sitting with you, but I'm quite sure you'd...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, which is Central Lynn and Lynn Counties. I'd like to preface my remarks by making a couple of comments about the impetus that leads us to bring a bill like this. In my district, there has been a proposal pending for a number of years now, I think over a decade, for the construction of a large power plant that would produce significantly more power than needed in the local area. It has gone through, without going into the details, it has gone through a number of permutations in that planning cycle, and a number of different potential builders have come and gone, including companies which are now in bankruptcy and are no longer obviously interested in involved. One of the things that is of major importance to me is that in all of this process, the local county commission has had, if anything, only an ancillary role in any of the considerations that have been involved. All of the applications made and so forth have been made through other processes, and in effect, the local people have had very little to say about this application. This bill, as I understand it, won't apply to that application, but we're hoping that other locales might have better experiences than some of my constituents have had in their work trying to deal with this for them very difficult problem. We bring this bill, or at least I have added my name to this bill because I believe that in this kind of instance, local government is the best government to make decisions affecting the local community. Local government must comply with statewide and local land use laws. They're bound by law to rule on substantive applicable land use criteria. Public hearings should be held on land use criteria, and local jurisdiction will make a fact-finding based on the record. As energy becomes more diversified, local communities will need to play a role in determining their energy resources, which includes, of course, solar, wind, cogeneration, and I would say distributed generation as well. As the technology develops for distributed generation, the need, we hope, for these very large polluting power plants may actually decline as local users are in a better position to generate their own power as a result of the technological developments that are occurring in that area. We also believe, although this bill, at least as our proposed amendments go, will not, I think, directly affect this area, would require, we ought to have a needs standard. The Energy Siting Facility Siting Council, under the old rule, was allowed to make siting decisions in the best interest of the greater public. If the state or region needed energy development, the state could understandably prevail over local land use concerns. And I would point out that currently pending in the state of Oregon is several times the amount of power production that we anticipate needing in the reasonably foreseeable future. I think, Mr. Chair, I'm going to stop there and ask Ms. Arkin to make her remarks, and then I'll be available for questions.
Thank you. I wanted to bring forward the kind of the other half of this bill, which is Klamath County, and a better spokesperson for that than I is the wife of Senator Whitsitt, who is here, Gail Whitsitt. And if I could ask you to come up and join this panel to please just come on up and sit down. You're walking very well.
I have prepared testimony that will discuss what
you need to identify yourself.
My name is Gail Whitsitt, and I'm from Klamath County. My husband is Senator Doug Whitsitt, who's here in the legislature now. He couldn't be here today. He wanted to be here, but he had a committee meeting in Dundee for the Department of Transportation at exactly the same time. So he is bringing forward a bill in the Senate, 527, I believe, along with Senator Morissette, which addresses similar points that we have here. And this all stemmed from our initial knowledge of this from a two-year process that we've been through with the siting of the California-Oregon border electrical generating facility down in Klamath. And so my testimony will pretty much cover what our experiences have been, but it's basically been a lack of input from the community. Everything has been done outside of the community from another level, and we've been forced to live with it, essentially. Okay, sure. Chairman Girard and members of the committee, I am here today to testify regarding the overly broad Oregon Department of Energy's process for siting gas-fired electrical generating plants. My experience comes from a two-year ordeal of dealing with this exceedingly powerful department while they have permitted the California-Oregon border plant. This massive 1,160-megawatt facility will be located on EFU-zoned agricultural land in a rural area of Klamath County. As a multi-degree geologist who attended both Oregon State University and Princeton University with many years of professional experience, I have been both shocked and dismayed at the overreaching powers afforded the Department of Energy in this state. In my own experience, the department routinely exceeded statutory authority regarding the seismicity and geologic findings of the power plant site, as well as the land use zoning in the area. In my professional geologic opinion, the site, which directly overlies a 10-mile-long massive normal fault with over 2,000 feet of vertical displacement, has not been properly assessed according to OAR 345-022-0020. In other words, the Department of Energy allowed the applicant, People's Energy of Chicago, to skip compliance with parts of the structural standards section of the law and sited the plant over the fault without adequately characterizing the site for seismicity and potential ground motion. The department and the applicant have consistently dismissed the law. They have stated that because this process was previously undertaken at another plant site in Oregon, I believe it was Hermiston Summit Generating Facility, and because they did not follow the statute at that site, there is now precedent to repeat the violation of statute wherever and whenever they choose. Perhaps I am old-fashioned, but I believe that we have laws for a reason, and in this case, it is for the public safety. The department's reason for avoidance of compliance with Oregon law was that People's Energy alleged that it was too expensive to determine whether the site was geologically appropriate before citing. As a result of this allegation, the department agreed to mitigate the law and try to determine whether the site was appropriate after the plant was cited. This is worse than backward thinking. It is, quite frankly, in violation of Oregon law. This case is now scheduled for review by the Oregon Supreme Court, where this structural standard requirement violation is a primary part of the case. A similar process of mitigating Oregon water law was exercised by the Department of Energy. The department provided Peoples Energy a groundwater permit in an aquifer where more than 35 farmers and ranchers have groundwater drought permits. Some of these ranchers have waited for more than 10 years for these drought permits to be confirmed in a water rights certificate. Yet by applying mitigating conditions to the Peoples Energy certificate, the department provided the company with a secure water source in direct contradiction to Oregon and Western water law. When directly asked on the record for the statutory authority for this mitigation, the Department of Justice response was that technically there was no statutory authority, but that because such statutory authority does exist in the Deschutes River watershed, they would simply do it in the Lost River watershed as well. The entire Bonanza subbasin may have their irrigation wells shut down due to a lack of groundwater, yet this massive facility will still have the right to keep pumping groundwater from the same aquifer while everyone else is shut off. In citing this plant, the department violated or manipulated virtually every land use regulation regarding exclusive farm use. The applicant alleged that the selected site was unique because it was near the intersection of high voltage transmission lines, a high pressure natural gas line, and a previously untapped groundwater aquifer. It was alleged that this uniqueness authorized breaching the EFU land use regulations. However, as the siting process developed, the allegation that the groundwater source was a previously untapped aquifer was proven false by both the Oregon Water Resources Department and the United States Geological Survey hydrologists. The proximity to the high voltage transmission lines was irrelevant because the applicant was not allowed by BPA to access those lines near the site. In fact, the applicant agreed to build 7 miles of high-voltage transmission lines in order to deliver their electricity to the nearest BPA substation at an additional estimated cost of $44 million. The only uniqueness in the proximity to the natural gas transmission line is the proximity to the pressure booster Bonanza pumping station that will allow Peoples Energy to use natural gas to fire its turbines without recompressing the gas. This uniqueness is economic at best. In spite of the foregoing commonly known facts, and in clear violation of Oregon land use law, the Energy Facility Siting Council voted unanimously to site the plant in the exclusive farm use location due to the uniqueness of the site, of which there was none. Because of the supersiting powers afforded the Department of Energy by the legislature in the past, they are now an out-of-control, megalomaniacal department who will answer to no one. They simply mitigate any laws that stand in their way of citing. They then cite the illegal action for precedent at subsequent citing locations. This is a truly dangerous path to go down. The Oregon Department of Energy is well on the way to practicing a totalitarian or authoritarian method of government. This department's total disregard for Oregon statutes and for its citizens has been one of the most frustrating experiences I have encountered in a professional capacity working on projects with both state and federal governments. I am asking you in your capacity as legislators to rein in this agency and limit or remove the supersiting powers of the Department of Energy and the Energy Facility Siting Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important matter and for your time and consideration. Signed, Gail and Doug Whitsitt. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Whitsitt. Any questions of Representative Barnard or Mrs. Whitsitt? Representative Greenway.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Whitsitt, you present a compelling case for an agency is violating the law. Why don't we just do something to make them follow the law rather than changing the law?
That would be fine, too. I don't know how how to do that. I mean, it's that is the problem. There are laws on the books, but they want to mitigate the laws. That's the term they use. No matter what we're in, it comes out to, well, we'll just mitigate this and mitigate that, and then the law has, essentially, the statute has no effect.
It's very odd to me, I must say.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I have just one more question I'd like to ask my roommate, Representative Beinhart, my apartment mate. So, I think we have some horror stories here that I think are very compelling horror stories. But there are some exciting things that are going to need to happen. And I was particularly concerned about the question of citing alternative energy models, which many of us really like to see happening, wind and thermal and a variety of other kind of energy sources. Would there be some room in this bill to find some way to cite the smaller alternative energy models without all the complexities that we're adding to it here? Or
I think we're going to have to answer that question. Ms. Arkin, yet.
Okay, hold the question in.
Hold the question, and we'll have Ms. Arkin testify. But I can let, if there are any other questions for Representative Barnhart or Mrs. Whitson, I can let them go back to.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I'm totally happy to sit here for a few more minutes and let her do her initial testimony and then answer additional questions at that time if that's agreeable to the chair.
So be it. Mrs. Arkin?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and esteemed members of the Land Use Committee. My name is Lisa Arkin, and I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Toxics Alliance. And let me tell you why I'm here to talk about energy facility siting process. Three separate rural farming communities contacted the Oregon Toxics Alliance about what to them was an unacceptable situation. Independent energy developers wanting to build large gas-fired power plants on their farmland had identified these communities as advantageous sites. The folk were from Klamath Falls, Coburg, and Turner, and they were worried about the loss of valuable farmland, impacts to their farming practices, and economic losses to their farming business, damage to their waterways, impacts to other small local businesses, and damage to the air they breathe. Many of those representatives from those residents are here today, and also I'm hoping that you received by email or fax testimony from the mayor of Turner. Should have reached you yesterday. He was unable to be here and hoped that I would mention his testimony to you.
We have not received that.
So, I just thought I'd let you know.
I have one copy and I could make copies. Thank you. In each case, the people and at least a good percentage of the elected officials felt that the agencies that control the energy facility siting certification process dismissed and did not respect public input in the pending land use decisions. In all three cases, the proposed energy facilities did not meet local land use criteria. However, the impacted community is only advisory, and when the Energy Facility Siting Council approves the site certificate, the local jurisdiction is, and I quote here from Energy Facility Siting material, is obliged to issue the conditional use permits without any further process or conditions. The council's decision is binding on all local and state agencies that must issue permits. Close quote. The communities that contacted us felt strongly that the Energy Facility Siting Council's sole power to make the land use determination in the case of siting energy facilities violates Oregon's history of thoughtful land use planning. The core of Oregon's land use laws is that the local jurisdiction establishes a code that incorporates the provisions of 19 statewide planning rules. This integration between the statewide land use planning framework and local implementation without sacrificing local control or private property rights is a definitive feature. Government is best which is closest to the people affected by its decision. In contrast, the Energy Facility Siting Council has supersiting authority for power plants. The original energy siting law set forth a streamlined process for quick approval of energy facilities because of fears of energy shortages in the 1970s. The original intent of the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Rules recognized that cost, reliability, and adequacy of electricity has statewide significance. However, it is important to note that the original law also provided a public benefits balance. This foundation based the issuance of a site certificate on the need for a facility. It outlined an adequacy of supply standard that provided a demonstration of public good and public benefit. Such demonstration is required before the state should allocate common resources held in the public trust. A demonstration of public benefit should be required in connection with the state's ability to override local concerns if unwanted facilities are required for the greater public good. However, in 1999, the Oregon Legislature passed Senate Bill 1149, which encouraged the development of a competitive energy market. This bill had the positive result also of setting aside significant resources for energy conservation and greenhouse gas offsets. However, one result of Oregon's electricity restructuring was the increase in applications to build gas-fired power plants by independent producers. Many of these are merchant gas power plants, meaning that they sell energy on the open market to the highest bidder and are not necessarily serving an identified customer. And in fact, between 1996 and 2004, 11 applications for gas-fired power plants with a total generating capacity of 5,797 megawatts were submitted to the Oregon Department of Energy. Approval has been granted for 7 plants capable of producing over 4,200 megawatts of electricity. The 3 fossil-fueled projects in the communities I have previously mentioned are currently under consideration. Yet, according to the nonpartisan Northwest Power and Conservation Council, we have sufficient energy reserves until the year 2011 or 2012, and we are predicted to achieve at least 2,900 megawatts of conservation in the next 20 years. With the criteria for siting power plants now based on market competitiveness and not an adequacy standard, it's difficult to convince communities that the state has demonstrated the ability to override local concerns for the public benefit. Citizens and communities targeted for gas-fired power plant construction expressed concerns that providing energy for open markets that might be very far away while taking valuable farmland and water resources from the local population is not fair. So it's understandable that the residents of Coburg, Turner, and Klamath Falls want to have more public input into energy facility siting. And actually, it's more than just land and water. The entire town and surrounding areas may have important concerns about economic impacts to tourism or recreation, to businesses, to historic districts, to enterprise zones, to traffic, hazardous chemicals, public safety, and more. The Energy Facility Siting Council is best suited to assess the technical merits of an application, and local governments are best suited to evaluate land use decisions based on land use code. I did please distribute a little synopsis of the 3 amendments to this bill, just so you'd have them clearly in front of you, and I won't go through them. But I did want to point out there's a flow chart there of the energy facility siting process on one other sheet. And I put in there the little box showing where the public hearings would come in. And when you see the flow chart, I'm sorry, I didn't have one for you, Representative Barnhart, you can see that the amendment is asking for public hearings regarding land use criteria and for the local jurisdiction to participate, to call for those public hearings in conjunction with the Energy Facility Siting Council and to go through fact-finding together before a land use decision is reached. Also, we're asking in this bill to have a coordinated environment review. And if you notice on that flow chart, you don't see environment review anywhere. The Department of Energy does collect information on environmental impacts, but it's not coordinated so that the public has access to it and then can raise issues in the public hearing. So there's no regulatory impact of this bill. It simply asks for all that information to be gathered in a cohesive manner and made available for public comment. Please listen to the personal testimonies of the people of Oregon who have come before you today from Turner and Klamath Falls and Coburg. They can best describe their experience with the energy facility siting system. From others today, you might hear some characterize House Bill 3135 as NIMBY, or a not-in-my-backyard provision, or that it will hurt renewable energy development, or that it will give local government veto power in energy facility siting decisions. I have every hope that this bill will not hurt renewable energy projects. That would be my last desire. I am very much in favor of renewable energy, and I brought to get here with me just one copy of a publication from the Department of Energy about wind power, seeing how compatible it is with other land uses and how it's going to really be non-polluting and generating revenues for farmers. So I can't see that having local input would hurt renewable energy, specifically if it's non-polluting and a revenue-generating source. As for veto power, I think that the people of Oregon don't want to feel they're being crushed by an unresponsive state agency when local land use laws are brushed aside without a showing that the greater good is being served. The people of impacted communities want their concerns heard. They wish to offer into the siting process their knowledge of their community's unique terrains, natural resources, economic uses, and family heritage. The local jurisdiction has experience and expertise to consider the local land use decision. I thank you very much for allowing me to come before you today and express my interest in this issue, and I hope that you will support House Bill 3135. Thank you very much, and I'm here for comments and questions.
Any questions of our distinguished panel? Representative Greenberg, follow now.
Well, in regard to the alternative energy models, would you be interested in restricting the impact of this bill to gas fire generators and fossil fuel burning energy facility plants?
In the Senate version of the bill, there is a thank you very much, Mayor. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in the Senate version of the bill, there is a statement about prioritizing renewable energy projects and moving our state toward long-term energy planning that would encourage the development of renewables. And I'm hoping that in conversations that we can have as we move this bill forward in the House and the Senate, that we can address that topic. I've been in conversations with Northwest Renewable Energy Project, Northwest Energy Coalition, Citizens Utility Board, some of the staff and technicians from the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, technicians from EWEB. I've tried to talk to everyone I can, and everyone agrees that there's room to move forward here, and this is a great time to start. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
By the way, committee, we have letters from the Lane County Board of Commissioners. Does anyone have a copy of that? And we have located the letter from Mr. Thompson, the Mayor of Turner. So I believe everyone has that at their site. I was just curious, and perhaps Representative Barnhart, Ms. Witsit might answer this question. Do you believe that local government in your respective areas have the opportunity anywhere during the process to intervene?
for Klamath County, there was apparently one opportunity for our county commissioners to respond to the EFU, placing this on EFU land. And we had two commissioners who chose not to reply at the time, and one commissioner who did. However, the two commissioners said that they have consistently said that despite whatever input they had, it could be overridden by the Department of Energy, the FSEC board. So the answer to your question is there was apparently one time that they could reply. Two commissioners did not, one commissioner did, and they just didn't feel that it apparently would make any difference, was what they have said in public.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, in Lane County, there were, as I recall, and this is based on a faulty memory at this point, some action by the Board of Commissioners that was considered to be purely advisory. And I think the letter before you from the commissioners speaks for itself about their views about the project.
It does. Thank you, Representative. Ms. Arkin, Ms. Woodson, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
As is our custom, we will hear from those who have come the furthest. And we have 15 people signed up to speak, and so I'm going to ask each participant if they'll hold their testimony to 5 minutes or under, and I'll call forth Roger Hamilton, Lynn Brock, and William Brock, all of whom come over 100 miles. In committee, Mr. Hamilton is very familiar with these surroundings in that he was a former member of the Public Utility Commission, and as I recall now lives in my district. So welcome, former commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nice to see Chairman from Klamath County. On this committee and members of the committee, my name is Roger Hamilton. I actually reside at 511 Brookside Drive, Eugene, Oregon, but I'm headed to my ranch in Klamath County. I hope to be there this evening for my two-year-old grandson's birthday. I'm a member and manager of the Hamilton Family LLC, a cattle and hay ranch located in Langell Valley, near Bonanza, Oregon.
Currently a consultant in the wind
power industry. I was gratified to hear so many great things said about renewable energy. I'll have a few comments about that. Former member and chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, I also served as Governor Kitzhaber's Energy and Watershed Advisor. And during the time that Klamath County adopted its land use code, I can't recall if I was the chairman of the commission, but I was a member of the county commission at the time. At that time, we assured our constituents that its provisions provided local control over land use planning. And that is certainly going to be the focus of my comments today.
Mr. Hamilton, I apologize, too. I should have mentioned that you were a former Klamath County commissioner, so...
I'm actually prouder of that than any other accomplishments. It was a more difficult job, by the way. First, let me make it clear that as one who is engaged on a daily basis in advocating for the siting of energy projects, that is, as a consultant in the wind power industry, I want the process to work for developers of appropriate projects. I also wanted to accommodate the interests of local communities, protect individual property investments, including my own, and examine the quality of the projects. Unfortunately, this is currently not the case. In the mid-1990s, and I have to confess guilty as charged as being the person that to be included in this indictment, when the need standard was eliminated by the legislature, Oregon policymakers were infatuated with the idea that the invisible hand of the market, not local or state policy, should dictate where and when energy projects would be sited. The unanticipated consequence was that local communities became invisible to this invisible hand. The local land use control was trampled in the rush toward free markets. I need not remind you how this free market led to the California and then west-wide energy crisis and the infamous Enron scandal. We learned that unregulated energy markets are not free, in fact, that there are many market failures in production of electricity, particularly from large facilities. I believe we need to re-examine Oregon's energy facility siting process in order to make it consistent with local development and land protection under LCDC. We need to also make it fit the needs and aspirations of local communities affected by the projects, and most importantly in this case, to enable consistency with state energy policy. Listening to community opposition to proposed projects, and this is the proliferation of large natural gas generators brought this on when I was Governor Kitzhaber's energy advisor, from commissioners and from lots of farmers and residents in Marion, Lane, Umatilla, Deschutes, and Cook counties. You've heard about some of those today. I was led to suspect that there was something wrong with the existing statute. My participation in the ETSEC hearings in my own community in eastern Oregon confirmed my suspicion that the process is woefully insensitive to economic, environmental, and cultural values of rural communities. A sign posted by my nearest neighbor in Langell Valley reads, "Stop the Cobb, we don't want it, we don't need it." And a lot of people who see that say this is just another NIMBY statement. But no statement better captures the prevailing, virtually unanimous opposition to this plant proposal in my neighborhood. Yet the residents of Langell Valley found their objections to the plant frustrated at every turn, as reflected in the staff recommendation and final order in this case. These documents asserted that many of the values that the agricultural goal was designed to protect, Goal 3, and the state's own energy policy asserted fell outside the council's jurisdiction. These declared irrelevancies included impact on access to the existing transmission system for competing generation, the state's own policy on renewable energy and greenhouse gas emissions, the rural economic development potential of alternative sites that might have provided steam services for agricultural processing. I think this was a particularly egregious oversight in this case. Natural gas price volatility and trends, energy independence and security, and most importantly for this particular committee, the Land Use Committee, the degradation of property values when an obtrusive industrial use is allowed in a serene rural setting. Without burdening you with the litany of objections that the community opponents consistently raise, let me summarize in one simple statement. The size of the California-Oregon border facility triggered an exception to the agricultural goal. This facility is 120 acres, and has a generation capability of 1,160 megawatts of electricity. This would might be appropriate for Portland, Seattle, or San Francisco, but it is too large in size, scale, and operational characteristics to fit smoothly within the rural landscape of Klamath County. But raising these objections for me was like playing a basketball game in which there's only one basket, and that is on one side of the court we were defending. We could take the ball down the court, but there was no way to score. It was a nightmare. Most of our concerns were rural out of order. The proponents of the project were eventually down the wind. Those who choose to live in rural eastern Oregon have traded the economic opportunities of urban living for non-monetary rewards tied to a more pristine rural environment. This value choice is undermined by siting industrial-scale thermal plants in rural areas. In almost every case, the developer is out of state, and the financial rewards of the project are reaped by out-of-state shareholders. The argument that the developer's risk in a competitive market does not mean that the risk taken by affected property owners in the neighborhood of the facility should be disregarded. We don't live and do business in remote and relatively pristine corners of rural Oregon to make a lot of money. Take away those qualities that uniquely pertain to rural living, and we're left with almost nothing. This bill is designed to remedy many of these concerns. With some modifications, and I myself, as someone involved in energy development, had some concerns about capacity caps. But with some modifications, it deserves the support of the renewable energy community and rural economic interests of the state. It deserves the support of all Oregonians who believe in local control and input into land use decisions. It deserves the support of all who believe that Oregon's energy future should benefit Oregonians first and be aligned with the interests of local communities. The existing statute was designed to encourage the development of independent power production and foster new energy technologies in Oregon. And I'm all for that. I thoroughly support that. Most of the plants that I'm involved with are merchant plants. This is the work I do. Unfortunately, an unintended consequence was to invite the energy projects that are not aligned with state energy policy or with local land use planning and the virtual rubber stamping of project applications by FSEC if permitting conditions and off-site mitigation requirements are met. This bill offers an alternative approach that matches development opportunities and profitability with the aspirations and values of our governments. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Hamilton? Thank you, Roger, very much. Ms. Fry.
Thank you, Mr. Gerard, Chairman Gerard, and members of the committee for letting us speak here today. My name is Lynn Brock. I live in Bonanza, Oregon, in Klamath County. I am one of many people from Bonanza, Oregon, in Klamath County who has spent much of my time and a lot of money for the last 3 years trying to protect my property rights, health, way of life, and means of making an income from farming. Mrs. Whitsett has addressed many of my concerns about water and the geology of the area and whatever, so I will not restate those concerns. As Americans, we are often told to contact our elected officials. We tried to contact the governor. Our messages were sent to Department of Energy for them to reply to us, so we have never known if the governor even heard of our concerns. Our elected senator and representative met with us and said to express how we felt, but this process that's in law now does not consider local landowners' or residents' wishes. Our early and strong input caused some important amendments to be made to the process in the plant that's siting itself there, but we learned that our convictions and hard work meant we had shot ourselves in the foot, so to speak. We had fixed early in the process many problems that might later have been legal issues on which we could have stopped the siting during the contested case phase. So we helped the applicant. Later in the process, we found that if we hadn't brought something to the attention of DOE at the right phase or by the right date, we could not bring it up, even if it were a misstatement of fact or an untruth printed in the applicant's written information. As an example, one we can all understand that doesn't talk about tons of some unknown chemical pollutant that maybe we wouldn't know about. The Cobb final order states simply that Klamath County is one of the least populated counties in Oregon. It isn't. Depending on whether one is talking about population or population density, Klamath is either 13th from the top of 36 counties or 13th from the least populated. Department of Energy told us that they chastised Cobb's attorneys after this statement was made at the hearing, and yet it is still printed uncorrected in your final order. Now, when considering risk management, such as how many lives can be endangered for a $650 million project, this fact or misstatement could allow a facility to be sited there in spite of the risk to human lives, and yet they don't even know how populated our county is. Speaking of risk, we asked a representative of DEQ how levels were set for allowable amount of pollution. He said, it's what is safe for a normal, healthy adult. He paused and then he added, of course, it could be harmful to infants, children, or the elderly, or anyone with a compromised health condition. Now, Oregon state law should protect its residents, its constituents, and its resources. This process doesn't allow these considerations. Agriculture is a very important industry in Oregon. And, of course, being able to feed itself and help feed millions in other countries is part of what has made America a strong country. We should not be placing unneeded energy facilities on land zoned for exclusive farm use. We should protect ag land for the production of a safe and abundant food supply. The law states that 4 uses can be made if needed on EFU land. I believe these are church, school, cemetery, or a power plant. It would seem reasonable and rational that if there's a small town such as Bonanza surrounded by EFU land, and as that town grows, it might need to use EFU land for one of these, a church, a school, a cemetery, or a power plant, to provide the services for that small town, not for a huge for-profit corporation to use Oregon resources to provide, generate power for out of the area, like for California. It would seem to make sense, but it doesn't make sense to place this there when it doesn't need to be there on ag land, and it isn't needed for the state of Oregon. I could probably speak for hours on the problems we've encountered with existing law and what it has cost us in effort, time, and dollars. The process does need to be changed. I ask you on behalf of myself and hundreds or thousands of others in Klamath County for whom I have volunteered to speak, please change the law concerning the siting of energy facilities. Many farm families in Langell Valley have been there for generations and have 3 or 4 generations there now. Their health and their livelihoods will be affected, yet they have really no say in this process that is steamrolled over the top of them. Their investment is in their land and in their equipment and in their crops. It is not in a 401k, and yet their property rights and their values are affected, and they have little say. How will they mitigate for the health of a 70-year-old farmer who is still probably working as a farmer, or his 4-year-old great-grandson? How will this company that comes in with their millions or billions of dollars, how will they mitigate for a family's land that they've owned for 70 or 80 years? Just say, oh, here, we'll give you what it's worth, and you can move someplace else. That isn't right. Members of the Siting Council don't seem to even have to have required credentials. One member is a paid lobbyist for the labor unions, and this is a huge conflict of interest because the labor union men were some of the main people speaking in favor of this plant being sited down there, and yet they would have jobs if it were sited in an industrial area. It wouldn't have to be sited in a farm area for them to have jobs. Okay, the Siting Council members had not even read the application or all of the applications. Some of them maybe hadn't read any of it at our contested case phase, which is near the final phase of the process. Some of them said they would go back and read certain parts of it because they had doubts, but then they voted that day, I believe that very day, to accept the draft final order. Frustrated at every turn, as stated by Roger Hamilton, sums up the process. Even where known legal issues were raised and should have been considered and should have made a difference. These farmers produce beef for your dinner, milk for your children, oats and potatoes for staples in the American diet. We need to protect farms and farmers. Thank you very much.
Mr. Brush.
It's going to be kind of hard to talk.
It's going to be hard to follow that.
Yes, sir.
My name is Bill Brock. My wife and I farm in Langell Valley. We live at 31100 Horsefly Lane. And we traveled here today to express our support for this bill. I believe that this is a first step in a much-needed reform in our state's energy facility siting standards. As has been stated earlier, frustration is the only thing that I can say I feel from this entire process. We were involved after the fact, after the behind-the-scenes lobbying went on to try and have this thing put in the area. The company didn't contact the local power people. They just got a engineering firm and a Portland law firm. They came down and said they're going to build it. They didn't come down and ask where would be a good place to put it, what is the need. They decided to just come in and do it. So it was behind the scenes. I say this as somebody that's been for the last 10 years in the power industry in the basin. This was a bad location to start with. They came down, said they were going to tie right into the three power lines right there in the valley. They were told at that meeting they couldn't do it. The owners of the power lines would not let them. They said, oh, yes, we will. We're a big firm. We have lots of money. This will bring lots of money into the county. The owner said, no, you won't put it here. You won't tie in here. You'll have to run a power line. Thus, the 7 miles and $44 million to run a power line to a local substation. Everything, as I said, was frustrating. We thought at first we might have some input into the process. We read the siting standards on the internet, and we thought, oh, here's a place we can have public comment. But it turns out the public comment was only to find problems in the application so that the applicant can fix them. Our concerns were not really addressed. We were stifled. We were pushed back and said, we know what's best for you. We went to our county commissioners and said, this is not what we want. We want to have some say here. If they're going to try and come out here, we want to be able to have them throw something at us instead of having them stomp on us. And they said, oh, we can't do that. We can't ask for anything. When, in fact, the plants in Hermiston did get something out of the process. They wouldn't listen to us. They listened to the proponent's attorneys. Stifled again. Frustrated again. We followed this process for over 2 years. There were times I was so mad I could scream, I could break something. I tried not to. My wife kept me from breaking a lot of things. We'd go to meetings and nothing would come of it. I was born in Eugene, spent most of my life on the west side of the mountains because I thought that's where we made money. I've always wanted a farm on the east side. I finally got one in 97. We're out in the middle of this valley. My front window is a big valley with some farms and some farmland. And now there'll be four of these ugly stacks coming over the hill. You might not be able to see the pollution coming out of them, but they'll be there.